We are going to go back to Israel after David today. We're going to be talking about going through 2 Kings chapter 4. We had done Psalms for a few weeks, and so we're going to go take a little break from the Psalms just for this week, I think, and go and continue on the ministry of Elisha. Now, if you remember, in 2 Kings chapter 3, Elisha was being established as the successor to Elijah, because Elijah had been taken up to heaven by God, and then the prophets were the first people to see this and to understand that Elisha was the successor, and then the people of Jericho, and then the kings of both Israel and Judah and Edom as well. And that happened in 1 Kings chapter 3. Now we're going to continue with what happened with Elisha. And part of this narrative also establishes an increased awareness of Elisha in the land, taking over as the successor to Elijah. Now, we also had that the disrespectful throng at Bethel that also, you know, when many, 42 of them died, I think it was 42, and because they were disrespecting Elisha, that again, that was another thing that established more of Elisha being the successor. So the first thing that happens in chapter 4 is we have Elisha multiplying oil. And this is in 2 Kings 4, 1 through 7. It says, "Now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, 'Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord. And the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves.' Elisha said to her, 'What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?' And she said, 'Your maidservant has nothing in the house except for a jar of oil.' And he said, 'Go borrow vessels at large for yourself from all your neighbors, even empty vessels, and do not get a few.'" Get a bunch. Okay? Verse 4, "And you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons, and pour out into all these vessels, and you shall set aside what is full." So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons. They were bringing the vessels to her, and she poured. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And she said to her, and he said to her, "There is not one vessel more." And the oil stopped. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go sell the oil and pay your debt. You and your sons can live on the rest." Quite a story. Quite a story.
What would a vessel look like?
It would have been a kind of a clay pot.
Yeah.
Not huge, because you have to be able to pick it up and move it. But it would have, you know, like they had, you know, in those days. Now, it's interesting here, if we look at the narrative, one of the groups of the prophets had died. So this was a person who supported Elisha, and his widow with her two children find themselves in debt without any ability to pay. Now, that was not uncommon in that culture. When the husband died, the provider died, you were kind of destitute. Their only recourse was to sell her children into slavery and to pay the debt. How would you like to have that as your only recourse? Paul House points out that this narrative also gives us a glimpse into the lives of the prophets of that day. At least for some, they led fairly normal lives. It wasn't like he was a prophet all the time. He was doing something that brought in income so they could continue their household, and he had families and the responsibilities that come with families. Now, we don't have insight into how much of their time was devoted to religious activities. We don't know. But it's clear that because of the death of the husband, that the economic support of the family was gone. Now, another thing to note was the impact of losing your financial support. Your children could be sold into slavery. There was no welfare state. Oh, go get food stamps. No. No such animal. Selling your children. Now, we need to understand that slavery at that time, it was a whole lot different, far, far different than what we think of when we think of slavery. Because we think of slavery as it took place in the United States, especially in the southern part of the United States. Slavery here was far different. I'm not saying that's anything that you might have opted for, but it wasn't like it was then. Slavery at that time was commonplace. And all nations had slaves. God gave Israel laws for slaves, which was not the same as other nations, but there were laws governing how you treated slaves. Slaves had rights in Israel's social system, unlike other nations. When we think of slavery, it usually conjures up the image of racial prejudice. But this was not the case here, because slavery was not race-based. They did not treat slaves as non-humans or treat them as animals, but as men made in the image of God. Now, Israel, this I thought was very interesting. The majority of slaves in Israel were Israelites. Some sold themselves into slavery, and we see this in Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 15. Others were sold to pay debts, which is what we see here. We see that in 2 Kings 4 here and also in Nehemiah chapter 5. They could also purchase slaves from foreign slave dealers. We see that in Leviticus 25. And these foreigners were in this state either by poverty or by crime. Now, the majority of non-Hebrew slaves were captives taken in war or battle, or their children that were born to them to the house of the master. They remained slaves, being the class described as born in the house, and we see that in Genesis chapter 14 and 17. Now, I said that there's different rules, and one of the rules was this: the penalty for stealing or making merchandise of a human being or a slave, whether one was an Israelite or a foreigner, was punishable by death. So you didn't treat them as a possession or a property or you treated them as a human being. Safe slavery was also considered more of an occupation, a servanthood with rights. Now, Jewish slaves could not be held for more than 6 years. So if this lady was going to sell her children, she would have sold them for 6 years. And after that, they were given a choice to leave. And we see that from Exodus 21. They could, if they wanted to voluntarily choose to remain a slave. Those who came into slavery with a wife and children, when they left that six-year thing, they could take their wife and children when they left. They were part of, they could do that. Jewish slaves were to receive their freedom at the year of Jubilee, and that was in Leviticus 25. They could voluntarily choose to remain. The Hebrew slave was freed at the sabbatical year, including his wife and children, unless he formally consented to remain in continuous servitude. You see, it's a whole lot different than what we had here. Slaves who were abused by their masters for any reason were to be set free. Leviticus 24 says this, if a man injures his neighbor, just as he done, it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. To both the Israelite and the stranger, or the non-Israelite, provision was made for the protection of his body. You couldn't just treat them poorly. If the master struck out an eye or destroyed it, blinding the slave with a blow or struck out a tooth, he was to be compensated by giving his servant his liberty. So if you hurt him, he was free. If he was to let him go free for the loss of whatever happened to his body. The willful murder of a slave was followed by capital punishment. If you murdered a slave, you were put to death. Now the slaves also enjoyed some rights. Foreign slaves seeking asylum in Israel were to be protected. See this in Deuteronomy 23. Also, this is, I thought was very interesting, slaves had economic rights, including the right for them to own a slave. So a slave could be a slaveholder. Okay? We see that in 2 Samuel 9. Slaves, this is also interesting, and your mind might go, Slaves were redeemable for a price. The average value was 30 shekels. What did Judas get? 30 pieces of silver. The nation of Israel also had state slaves. And this was similar to a civil service employee that we might think. They worked for the state. So here in 2 Kings 4, the woman was faced with no other option than to sell her children into this type of slavery. I thought it was important that we talked about what slavery was. Because, you know, when I first read it, you think, well, you know, we bring it into our history. You can tell that our history wasn't even close to what the biblical mandate was. Well, that's not the only thing it wasn't close to, but anyway. But still, you wouldn't want to sell your children into slavery.
Depends on the day.
Now, there's nothing that I read that said you could sell your husband into slavery. But with this predicament, she reached out to Elisha, whom I imagine she would have known now through, you know, because of her deceased husband, who was a prophet. So Elisha came to her aid with the power of God and multiplied her inventory of oil so she could sell her excess and keep from selling her two children. At the end of the narrative, you might have noticed that Elisha is called the man of God. What this also points out is that God knows and cares about both the big picture, the nations, the leaders of nations. But he also cares about the widow that no one knew about with her two children. No one outside of her little group would have ever known her. She's not even named. You know, Jesus spoke to this in Luke chapter 12, verses 4 to 7, when Jesus said this, I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that have no more they can do. But I will warn you with whom to fear. Fear the one who after he has killed has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 cents? Yet not one of them is forgotten before God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows. So this woman, in her obscurity, was provided for by God. And that's what we see in the first four verses. First seven verses, excuse me. The next thing we have in this chapter is Elisha raising a young man from the dead. And this starts in chapter 4, verses 8. And it goes all the way through verse 37. It says, "Now there came a day when Elisha passed over to Shunem, where there was a prominent woman, and she persuaded him to eat food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat food. She said to her husband, 'Behold now, I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Please, let us make a little walled upper chamber and let us set a bed before him there and a table and a chair and a lampstand. And it shall be when he comes to us that he can turn in there.'" Let's provide for him. Verse 11. "One day he came there and turned into the upper chamber and rested. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Call this Shunammite.' And when he had called her, she stood before him, and he said to him, 'Say now to her, Behold, you have been careful for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Would you be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the army?' And she answered, 'I live among my own people.' So he said, 'What then is to be done for her?' And Gehazi answered, 'Truly, she has no son, and her husband is old.'" Can remind you of Abraham, doesn't it? "And he said, 'Call her.' And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And he said, 'At this season, next year, you will embrace a son.' And she said to him, 'No, my lord, O man of God, do not lie to your maidservant.'" Don't tell me these stories. You can get my hopes all up. Verse 17, "The woman conceived and bore a son at that season, the next year, as Elisha had said to her." So in verses 8 to 17, we have the background. The Shunammite woman and her husband had gone to some effort to provide for Elisha. "You come through, you need a place to stay." First, she perceived Elisha correctly to be a holy man of God. We see that in verse 9. Just how she caught on to this, how she knew that, we're not told. But after she perceived it, she just didn't say, "Oh, there's a holy man of God." She said, "How can I provide? How can I do something?" And she convinced her husband to provide and furnish a walled upper chamber for Elisha to stay when he was in town. So she got together and said, "We need to do something for this guy. I've got to think that Elisha had to go through that town with some regularity. If it was just once every blue moon, yeah. But there was, you know, some regularity that they did. But that's just conjecture. The next thing is, being childless in that culture was a big deal. There were a few examples of those in a similar situation in Scripture, Abraham and Sarah being the most prominent one, but there were others too. The mother of Samuel is another example. But as we see from verses 11 to 15, Elisha wanted to show his gratitude for what they had done. Now, this is not because they had earned something, that they did this to earn something. It's, "I want to thank you." And so he asked about her, and then she is told that she will have a son. And sure enough, God provided a son. I can only imagine the joy that this boy brought to the family. She'd given up all hope on that. Then starting in verse 18, several years later, we have the continuation of the story. "When the child was grown, the day had come that he went out to his father to the reaper." So his father was still around. "And he said to his father, 'My head, my head.' And he said to his servant, 'Carry him to his mother. When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon and then died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. Then she called her husband and said, "Please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return." He said, "Will you go to him today? It's neither new moon nor Sabbath." And she said, "It will be well." Then she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, "Drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you." In other words, go. If I get tired, tough. I get tired. Go. So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. And when the man of God saw her at a distance, he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Behold, there is the Shunammite." He recognized her a ways off. "Please run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?" And she answered, "It is well." Interesting answer. When she came to the man of God on the hill, she caught a hold of his feet. And Gehazi came near to push her away, but the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is troubled within her, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." Then she said, "Did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'?" Now in 1 Kings 17, we have the story in verses 17 to 24 of Elijah raising the widow's son. The same person who Elijah had provided flour and oil through a season of drought. Now we see that God is using Elisha in a similar way. Very, very similar situations. Again, it shows that Elisha was now taking the place of Elijah. Now, when her son died suddenly, the mother had a plan. You notice she didn't sit and wring her hands and go, "Well, what am I going to do? What am I going to do?" But she immediately jumped to action that involved reaching out to Elisha. After all, it was Elisha that said, "You're going to have a son," several years before. She demonstrated faith that Elisha would be able to address the situation and make things right, even though her son lay lifeless on the bed that Elisha used when he came through town. Perhaps she thought because Elisha predicted his birth that he could help her again. She may have reasoned that God wouldn't give her a son just to take him away a few years later. Who knows what was going through her mind? But she was going to act, and that's how mothers do. Even though you kind of want to sell them into slavery, you'd give your left arm for any of them, right? So when her son died suddenly, the mother had this plan. Now Shechem was located south of Nazareth. So if you go, you have Nazareth, and then you have Shechem, and then Shechem, Shunem, and then farther down you have Jerusalem. It's just a little bit south of the Sea of Galilee, but more kind of in the middle between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. That's where Shunem was located. Now we see from the text that she went to Mount Carmel to speak to Elisha about her son. Now from Shunem to Mount Carmel is about 18 and a half miles in a straight line. Probably 20 miles or so, maybe a little more or less, depending on how the roads went, because they don't go straight. That's one way. Okay? So quite a bit of time would pass before she could even get to where Elisha was to see her son. And from the outset, the woman had faith that all would end well. What did she do? Well, the first thing she did after her son died is she went and laid him on Elisha's bed. She didn't get him prepared for burial. She just went and laid him on his bed and shut the door. Then she set out to go to Elisha and tells her servant not to slow down. go. If I'm tired, I'm tired. If I tell you to stop, okay. But you knew that she wasn't going to tell him to slow down. The next thing is when she came to Elisha, Gehazi tried to deter her. Now, in what was far different than normal behavior for a woman in that culture, in that day, she grabbed a hold of Elisha's feet. I'm not going to let go here. And then when she spoke to Elisha, she reminded him that it was you who told me I would have a son. And it was not some wish that she had taken to Elisha when Elisha said, "What do you want?" "Oh, I need a son." Elisha went to her with that promise. She didn't go to him with that request. Did you notice that earlier? So when you look at what she did, her faith stands out. This type of faith was far from common. And then we see what happened in verses 27 to 39. Starting in verse 27, "Then he said to Gehazi, 'Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, do not salute him. If anyone salutes you, do not answer him, and lay my staff on the Lord, on the lad's face.' The mother of the lad said, 'As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you.' And he arose and followed her. Then Gehazi passed before them and laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was no sound of response. So he returned to meet him and told him, 'The lad has not answered.'" So he travels back, Gehazi, the 20 miles, goes up, lays Elisha's staff on his face, nothing. He'd been dead for a while by now. When Elisha came into the house, so Elisha was coming, behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. So he entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. It's always a good idea. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands and stretched himself on him, and the flesh of the child became warm. Now, why he did that, we don't know. It's just what he did. Then he returned and walked in the house once back and forth and went up and stretched himself on him, and the lad sneezed 7 times, and the lad opened his eyes. Can you imagine? Then he called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite." So he called her, and when she came upon him, he said, "Take up your son." And she went in and fell at his feet and bowed himself to the ground. And she took up her son and went out. I want to see the YouTube of that. Wouldn't that be cool? I'm wondering if we have those types of things in heaven. If we need them, we'll have them. But in this story, it's what's similar to Elijah did in 2 Kings 17. It's another reminder that God's spirit was on Elijah, and now it's on Elisha. Who can raise the dead but God? And here God worked through Elisha. And as I read this story, I was reminded of a very sad event that took place in December of 2019. You probably heard it. It's a bizarre story out of the Bethel Church in Redding, California, where they very publicly attempted to raise a 2-year-old girl who died suddenly and unexpectedly. Most 2-year-olds, if they die, is going to be unexpected, right? The mother of the child was a singer in the church. She sang in their music area. The mother wrote on an Instagram post, quote, "We are asking for prayer. We believe in a Jesus who died and conclusively defeated every grave, holding the keys to the resurrection power. We need it for our little Olive Elaine, who stopped breathing yesterday and has been pronounced dead by doctors. We are asking for bold, unified prayers from the global church to stand with us on that behalf, that he will raise this little girl back to life." And then after Olive died, the church tried for days to resurrect her. "No, we're not going to bury her yet. We're going to keep her for a while." Bill Johnson, the senior leader of the church, said in a video that there was a biblical precedent for believing in resurrection. In addition to Jesus raising the dead, Johnson said that Jesus commanded his disciples to do the same. He said this, quote, "The reason Jesus raised the dead is because not everyone dies in God's timing." Well, that takes away the sovereignty of God. Like, huh? And he goes on, "And Jesus could tell, and he would interrupt that funeral, and he would interrupt that process that some would just call the sovereignty of God." This guy is just out to lunch, okay? As expected, little Olive was not raised from the dead in spite of around-the-clock prayer meetings. I'm going to go off on a tangent here. It's not on my notes. But we seem to think that, and I've heard people say it, well-meaning, we need to pray hard. Like, that makes a difference? We're praying to the Almighty God. I heard someone say, you know, I have a friend, they got up in a Sunday school class, not in this church, said, I have a friend who's got, it was cancer or something, and we all need to get together and pray real hard. No, we need to pray to the God who can do everything. But that's what they were trying to do here. They're trying to pray hard and command that God act. And they had already taken the sovereignty of God out of the whole equation. They even had appeals on social media with, quote, it was called hashtag Wake Up Olive. When are these people going to realize that God chooses who will be prophets? God chooses who will perform, where he will perform miracles. And many false teachers today are not even close to what the real prophets of God were. Anyway, that just came to my mind, that whole story of Olive. Sad story. Sad story. But what was sadder is their reaction to it. But here we see what God did through Elisha. And that is the second portion of 2 Kings 4. And then we get to Elisha and tainted stew. Verse 38. When Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. And the sons of the prophets were sitting before him and said to his servant, "Put on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of prophets." Then one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered it from his lap full of wild gourds and came and sliced them into the pot of stew, for they did not know what they were. Well, it looks good. Let's throw it in, right? I wonder what they were. So they poured it out for the men to eat. And as they were eating of the stew, they cried and said, "O man of God, there is death in the pot." In other words, something's not right here. And they were unable to eat. But he said, "Now bring the meal," he being Elisha. And he threw it into the pot and said, "Pour it out for the people that they may eat." Then there was no harm in the pot. To me, this was an interesting story. You know, I asked, you know, maybe you asked the question, why did God include this? You know? One thing it does illustrate is God's protection and that he is with Elisha. The people who gathered to eat were the sons of the prophets, and they called out to Elisha to help them not be poisoned from what they were eating, showing that they looked to Elisha for help and guidance. So it's further establishing Elisha's ministry and his effectiveness. And just a little thing, just don't go out and gather some stuff that you don't know what it is and throw it into a stew. I would, you know, try to find out what it is first.
And if you don't like my spaghetti, don't say, "There's death in the pot."
That's probably a good idea. You just gave me a real bad idea, though. Okay. Then the last thing we have in chapter 4 is Elisha feeding 100 people with little food. And this starts in verse 42 to 44. Now a man came from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God, again, this is Elisha, bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in his stock. And he said, give them to the people that they may eat. His attendant said, what? Will I set this before 100 men? But he said, give them the people that they may eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over. So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. So here Elisha feeds 100 men with just 20 loaves of bread. Now I went out and tried to find out how big a loaf of bread would have been. And I couldn't. I mean, I looked all kinds of places, and I struck out. That doesn't mean I won't keep trying.
Look at Eddie's.
Look at Eddie's?
Eddie's Bakery.
Eddie's Bakery. They were probably smaller than that. But I was able to determine that bread was an important part of their daily diet. This wasn't a, you know, it was a big part of their diet. Because this was called out as a miraculous event, 20 loaves normally wouldn't feed 100 men. So I would assume the loaves were fairly small. Right.
That was for one
boy for one lunch. If they were the same size a few hundred years later. I thought of that, but I thought, there's enough time, I don't know. Yeah, but you know, the boy had 5 loaves of bread for lunch and 2 fish that fed 5,000 people. One factoid that is mentioned in the narrative, though, that I at first read over, and you probably did too, is that the bread brought by an unnamed man was of the first fruits, or baked from the first ripe grain. Now, from Numbers 18, we are told that the first ripe fruits of all that is in the land, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours, meaning the priests. So the priests were to be given the first fruits of what is in the land. And then it says, every one of your household who is clean may eat it. So it's talking to the priest. This is where the priests would get their food. R.L. Hubbard, and that was really hard for me to type his name out because I kept thinking L. Ron Hubbard, which that's the Scientology dude. But this was a guy that before him. He wrote regarding this, in this case, the man brought it to Elisha, bypassing in protest the apostate northern religious leaders at the sanctuary nearby Bethel, because the normal religious leaders of that day were following Baal, were doing all this other stuff. They weren't following God. So what normally would have been given to the priest was brought to Elisha and his prophets at this point in time.
Bruce, did you do any research on the name of that city, Baal Shalisha?
No.
That it starts with Baal is interesting.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that yes. Yeah, because that's anything but being dedicated to God, which ties into probably why they didn't want to give those guys the grain anyway, the first fruits. Now, as I read through this, and as you read through it, and as Vicki pointed out, in this narrative, is that it takes us right to Jesus feeding the 5,000 and the 4,000. Like the miracles that Jesus performed in feeding the multitudes, the miracle of Elisha likewise didn't impact the people. Maybe the people that were there, but you didn't see all these people, oh, look what God can do through Elisha. They didn't. The nation still kept on rebelling against God. When Jesus performed feeding the 5,000, did the people all turn to him and in mass come, so, oh, this is the Son of God? No, the very next day, the Pharisees went to Jesus and said, "What do you give us for a sign?" The very next day. Weren't you paying attention yesterday? Miracles like this do not impact people to turn to God. Like what I have said, and we'll say it again and again, it is not the absence of evidence that keeps people from believing in Jesus. It's the suppression of the evidence. That being said, more evidence will not change people's minds. If I could just give them one more proof why there is a God, they're not going to believe it anyway, because they're suppressing the evidence they have. And Romans chapter 1 is full of this type of stuff. The what changes their mind is the prompting of the Spirit of God. And that can and does change people from darkness into His marvelous light. That is a quick run through of 2 Kings 4. The next time we get to 2 Kings, we're going to have a very interesting story of the healing of Naaman from leprosy, which I don't know when we'll get to it, but we'll get to it in 1 Kings chapter 5.